Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. You are listening to Ida History, and you're listening to me, one of your hosts, Jeff Wade, sitting right next to Mr. Mark Iverson. What's going on, Mark?
Just ready to get profound about axe murder. Ooh. Or two or three or four.
I love a good axe murder.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, can't get much better than that. Or worse. I guess it should be worse.
Yeah. Are you sober after our last little trivia night episode?
Yeah, I'm just ready to talk about some real history. It's like apple blossoms and petunias. Yeah. And
how many lakes there are in Idaho or whatever. Yeah.
I'm like, shouldn't this be the geography podcast? Right.
Idaho Geography, brought to you by Mark and Jeff.
I mean, geography is important to any historian, but
it's true.
Yeah,
we're gonna be talking about some geography in this one, so strap on your geographer hat.
Okay.
So, Mark, did you have anything to tell the listeners? We're rolling with the 1970s van tour right now, right?
Yeah, we sure are. And it's been going really well.
I got to go last week. It was fun.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we narrowed it down to, about 3.5 hours. But we pack a lot in to that 3.5 hours, and we reduced the price by, $35. So it's definitely better value for the customer and us too. And I think it's a better product overall. Not that it was bad before.
That's great. It starts at the old pen and kind of winds its way down through all the way to Garden City and then on back, right?
Yep. And people look at us and go, what in the hell is that van doing?
I like sitting in traffic at stoplights and people are looking, and had that one guy yelling at us through the window. It was great.
Like in a good way, right?
Yeah. He was joking around and I can't remember what he said, but it was
remember
fun.
And then I slammed him off the road. And then, don't I feel bad?
Left him in a cloud of shag.
Yeah. We have shag to spear.
Yep. All right, Mark, how can people find more information about your tour?
Go to idahistory.com, events and tours.
That's right.
And we have little synopses. And if you choose to purchase a ticket to one of our tours, that's where you can start that process.
And of course, we're only working tours in the Treasure Valley area right now. So
yeah, I mean,
hopefully to expand someday.
Yeah, we would like to go elsewhere, but time and money. Yep. Time and money.
Oh, yeah. We'll get there.
Yes.
Anyway, Mark, why don't you tell our listeners, who are probably mostly from North Idaho, of course, what we're talking about on this episode today.
Yes. This story could probably be called Idaho's first, or one of the first, true crime stories. It's the tale of a multiple axe murder that shocked the Western Territories and led to a multi-state manhunt. The first legal execution in Idaho history were due to this crime in the Idaho Territory.
So some of the sources, Mark, I used on this story. I used a couple of books on this episode, Mark. One's called The Magruder Murders, Coping with the Violence on the Idaho Frontier, and that's by Julia Conway Welch. The author did a great job of diving into all the primary sources. That's why I refer to that book quite a bit. The only thing, she kind of skips around on the story quite a bit, so that's a little confusing, but still a great book. The other book is called This Bloody Deed, The Magruder Incident by Ladd Hamilton. That book's frustrating because it doesn't have the main character of the story on the cover as another guy. Also important to the story, but less so. Equally as important.
Yeah.
It's just confusing. So. Yeah. The interesting thing about that book is he wrote it as like a narrative, almost serialized, like it's made into like a, almost like a Western story.
Yeah.
But still stuck with the primary sources and the documents. So that's interesting.
Work of fiction or historic fiction, but it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's more, I guess, interesting to read. The story is also talked about in The Vigilantes of Montana by Dimmesdale and Vigilante Days and Ways by Nathaniel Langford, which are a couple books that I've referred to quite a bit, talking about vigilantes. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But Mark, why don't we introduce who we're talking about tonight? Would ya?
Let's talk about Lloyd Magruder, since his name is the one that stands out in this story. The Magruder family hails from Montgomery County, Maryland, via Scotland. Alexander Magruder was a soldier, but came to the United States in 1652.
So in Julia Conway Welch's book, it says that he came as a slave, which would be funny since the Magruder family ended up owning a plantation called Locust Grove, which of course means that they own slaves, right?
And Locust Grove, of local sure. street names.
Yeah.
Not that that has much to do with anything, but still.
Yeah. But I think Alexander was more likely like an indentured servant instead of an actual slave. Which, you know, in many cases it's similar to slavery, but not the slavery that we understand it as, right?
Yeah, I mean, he could, what, was 7 years or 8 years, somewhere in there, I guess, for servitude. And if you are a white person, from what I've read, and an indentured servant, you could be treated shitty, but you weren't treated as one might, or definitely treated chattel slavery, you know, a person of African descent.
And a lot of times why they agreed to become an indentured servant was to get passage to the United States, and then they worked off the cost of that passage for, like you said, 7 or more years.
So Lloyd's grandfather, Samuel Wade Magruder, fought in the French and Indian War and the Revolutionary War, and he was a member of the Continental Congress. Wow, that's some blue blood action, right there, isn't it? But Lloyd Magruder was born at the Locust Grove Plantation on July 7th, 1825. He was one of 13 kids born to his father, Lloyd Sr. His mother died when Lloyd was 10, and his father died when he was 11.
So a lot of this kind of sounds like we're skipping through stuff, and we are. But there's a lot of interesting details about Lloyd Magruder's life that we're not able to cover in this time span. It's just, I didn't want to be podcasting for 6 hours tonight, so I cut it down. I highly recommend the books that I just listed to get more information on this.
A summary.
Yes.
Yes.
In Washington, Kansas, on June 3rd, 1846, Lloyd joined a company of mounted infantry who was preparing to go to Mexico. Not for tacos and tequila, Mark, but for an invasion.
Ooh, the best type of travel. The United States and Mexico were at war. And many Southern men like Lloyd Magruder signed up to fight. The Mexican-American War and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which ended it, was supposed to add more slave territories to the Union. Instead, though, Texas was the last slave state added. And the rest to follow were free states, which upset the careful balance that Congress had tried to maintain for decades.
It's so weird calling someone from Maryland a Southerner, but at the time, they were.
Right, right. That, yeah, although, you know, I was in Tennessee, well, shoot, a long time ago, and I was like, you guys consider Virginia the South? And they're like, no.
Really?
And they're like, I'm like, well, would somebody from Mississippi or Alabama consider Tennessee the South? I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, how Southern can you be? I was like, speaking of fighting for the Confederacy, Virginia pulled the weight, right?
Yeah.
I mean, others did too, for sure, but
Robert E. Lee was a Virginian.
Yep, that's right.
So Magruder joined up to fight this war, and he provided his own horse and saddle, which were valued at $70. He became a private in the Quartermaster Corps under future President Zachary Taylor. You know anything about Zach Taylor?
Yeah, I know he's the guy that I see his picture, and I'm like, dude, that dude didn't look like he was in the best shape.
You know, it's crazy that presidents from back in the day, like, they all always looked, like, disheveled, and no one said anything about it.
No, I know, like, Polk.
Yeah.
You're like, look at that, Andrew Jackson.
Even Lincoln, a lot of his photos looked kind of disgruntled.
Yeah, but it's that backwoods ruggedness thing that kind of some presidents just really carried off.
Magruder was present during the Battle of Buena Vista, in which Taylor, with 5,000 men, fought over 14,000 Mexican defenders. Taylor won that battle, and with half the casualties of the Mexican army under Santa Anna. A month later, Santa Anna failed to stop General Winfield Scott at Cerro Gordo, allowing U.S. troops to capture Mexico City.
But Magruder missed his opportunity to be a glorious conqueror. He had been sent back to the United States as a recruiter. Magruder had to have been well-spoken and probably good-looking to get sent to convince more men to go to war. And on April 27th, 1847, he was promoted to second lieutenant. Well, that's the big jump right there from
private to second lieutenant.
From private.
Yeah.
He wasn't even a sergeant.
Nope.
Yeah, okay.
I think money, family money, probably had a lot to do with that.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Or earned laurels.
Yes. And then 4 months later, on August 10th, he was promoted to husband after marrying Miss Caroline Pelham. And shortly after, he left once more for Mexico, where he served in the occupation force. Shortly after, he sent his resignation letter to his commanding officer, citing in part his regret for missing the battle for Mexico City.
Shortly after sending that letter, though, he retracted it, probably because he found out that he would have had to pay his own way home. Well, if he would have had left the army while still in Mexico. A second letter stated he wanted to delay his resignation till he was home, which apparently the army accepted.
After his army service, Lloyd and Caroline went to Fort Smith, Arkansas, and then traveled overland to California. As a reward for his military service, Magruder was granted a 160-acre land warrant. Now, none of the sources that I found told me where this land was, but I dug through the government land office records and found that it was southeast of Batesville, Arkansas. And I believe that, if I'm following the chain right on the BLM website, that he sold a portion or all of that land soon after taking possession of it.
Probably because Lloyd had his sights set on California. He and Caroline settled in St. Louis, California. I didn't even know there was a St. Louis, right. California until we talked about this, but
yep.
Lloyd probably tried his hand at some mining, but decided instead to use his experience as an army quartermaster to open a store. Sadly, a fire ripped through the town and destroyed his store and all of his stock, which put him in a great deal of debt that he could not pay off.
So from there, the Magruders moved to Marysville, California, where Lloyd worked a number of jobs to support his family. He was a county clerk, a census worker, he published the California Express newspaper, then he served as a justice of the peace, and then he started to dabble in politics.
Oh, too bad for him, huh? He was elected as a county clerk by the Know Nothing Party. I like that name.
Really?
Why I do, the Know Nothing Party.
Do you know why they call it the Know Nothing Party?
No, why?
Do you know anything about them?
No, sir. I'm a good Whig.
So the Know Nothings were like the anti-immigration party, the really American, like American values, like the today we would call them right-wing conservatives, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so, you know, as a part of this Know Nothing Party, he was elected to the state assembly as a peace Democrat in 1860. This was a very tumultuous time in California politics and the rest of the country, really.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, California, too. Huh?
You mentioned he was a peace Democrat. You know anything about politics during this time? You had the peace Democrats and you had the war Democrats and then you had the Know Nothings and then the Republican Party was like brand new during this time. And so it was all very like, where's the power going? Yeah. So the split in the Democratic Party actually allowed Lincoln, a Republican, to get elected because a lot of people were voting for who they wanted, you know, as far as the Democrats go and what they wanted, if they wanted to abolish slavery or not. So they split the Democratic Party and allowed Lincoln to be elected.
Around the time of his election to the state assembly, Magruder was forced to sell off everything he owned to pay his debts, resulting from the fire back in St. Louis, California. In 1861 and 62, those years saw extensive flooding in Northern California, and this coupled with gold finds in Eastern Washington Territory, Idaho, at this time. Later.
Right.
Yeah, later.
It's confusing Washington, with all the territories and everything was changing
pick
so fast.
One, damn it.
Yep.
But it started an exodus for many residents in this area of California, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
One of the residents who decided to try his hand at the new gold districts was Lloyd Magruder. On April 29th, 1862, he left his family back in Marysville, California, and he headed for the Salmon River mines. Now, I can't imagine how hard it must have been for him to do this, as his daughter Eliza had just suffered a serious accident when she fell on a pair of scissors, which pierced one of her eyes in two places.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Poor kid. 57 days after setting off, Magruder arrived in Lewiston. Lewiston was about a year old at that time, and this was around 8 months before it became the temporary capital of the Idaho Territory. And if you'd like to learn more about that, go to our first official episode, not introductions, but Idaho Myths and Legends. Is that
Idaho Mythbreakers.
Idaho Mythbreakers, that's right.
We broke some myths on that one.
We got all up in them myths and broke them apart.
Confirmed some of them too, of course. But
oh, sure.
So Magruder, when he arrived at Lewiston, he registered at the Luna House Hotel, which was owned by the hero of our story, Mr. Hill Beachy. Beachy was born in Pennsylvania in 1822 and went to work as a pilot on the Mississippi River as a young man. When the Mexican-American War began, Beachy opened up a bakery to sell fresh bread to the sailors. When the Mexican War began, Beachy opened up a bakery to sell fresh bread to the soldiers that were headed to Mexico. In 1849, he and a group of friends decided to pick up stakes and head out to the Sandwich Islands for some adventure.
But instead, they heard about the fabulous gold find at Sutter's Mill and decided to head back to California to take part in the gold rush. Instead, they heard about the fabulous gold find at Sutter's Mill and decided to head to California to take part in the gold rush. In Eureka, Beachy opened a saloon called the Bell Union. And then, in Red Bluff, he built a hotel, which was the first Luna House. Beachy was well known in the gold camps as being generous, fun-loving, and loved a good practical joke. Perhaps his love of a good joke contributed to the folklore of the events to follow.
Now, some sources say that Beachy and Magruder had known each other in Northern California, which is possible since they did do business in the same part of the state. It is also possible that it was in fact Hill Beachy who convinced Lloyd Magruder to move to the Salmon River mines. And if so, that pretty much explains why Beachy did what he did, which we'll explain later.
Magruder established himself in Elk City, where he built a store and put together a pack train operation. So basically a pack train is a long string or like mules tied together via rope, and then items, sometimes like quite large. You know, a lot of the stamp mills and things that were used up in the mines were in parts attached to these long strings of mules, which are, I know in the case of Jesus Urquidy's out of Boise City, 100 long, you know, and they were packed to the teeth or armed to the teeth with repeating rifles and revolvers, shotguns, because they were carrying so much value. And so they're like, you know, moving flotillas, not flotillas, but you know what I mean?
They were trains. Yeah, basically. They were trains. They're freight trains, but they were on hoofs.
Yeah, they were hoof trains, you know.
And then they had what they were called, was it arpejos, which are these pack saddles that they carried a lot of the goods and supplies in, and each mule would have basically one on each side.
Well, yeah, and like I know reading about Jesus Urquidy's getting into the Boise Basin, among other places, or like Rocky Bar and stuff, like miners and other people that were up there in these towns depended on these mule trains for their very life.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if he didn't show up, they were starving. You know, so these guys were super important for a long time. Well, not...
They survived all the way up until roads and, you know...
Yeah, like...
Stuff were built.
They slowly developed coach roads, but, you know...
And, of course, the coach roads were based on the roads that these men traveled with their mules. So.
Right. Which, in many cases, were based on indigenous trails.
Which were based on game trails.
Game trails.
Yeah.
So thank you, deer.
Yep.
We digress. We went down the mule train there. The mule hole. That sounds wrong.
Yes.
But Magruder had learned the art of mule packing while he was in the Army.
Don't let anyone ever tell you the military doesn't teach you a marketable skill.
Oh, right. I know. It teaches you how to pack some ass. Right, you got to keep that one.
All right.
All right. <Diddy-diddy>.
Magruder's life and his death during this time were dependent on a series of major events. And we already talked about the Mexican-American War, the California Gold Rush. The first gold rush is in Idaho Territory. It was at this point of his life that a major event shaped the remainder of Magruder's short life.
So when prospectors and miners found the claims on the Salmon River mines were already taken up, they decided to keep heading east along the Nez Perce Trail and across the Bitterroot Mountains. There, in what is now western Montana, gold was found on Grasshopper Creek and in the town of East Bannock. Maybe you might know that, good listeners, that Idaho City in the Boise Basin, about 40 miles north of Boise City, well, it had first been called West Bannock.
Yeah.
Or Bannock, right? Or West yeah. Bannock. And then they changed it to Idaho City because East Bannock had been named before.
I'd read that it was changed by an act of Congress. Do you know that?
No.
I've read that, but I can never find the actual act that did that. So I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
Well, either way, they changed it. And that was one of your most populated cities at that time period. So, they changed the name to Idaho City. And
that remains today.
Yes, it does. Not quite the bustling burg that it was, but a lot less murder.
But yeah, and then East Bannock got to keep its name. So
yeah, okay, yeah. Montana
still called Bannock, Montana.
Yeah. So anyway,
that sprung up, right?
Yeah, that sprung up.
So back in Elk City, which Mark Elk City. Is like east of Grangeville, Riggins, kind of in the wilderness there, right?
Just to put that in. Yeah, I think so. It's one of your older towns, too. Yeah.
So it's north of Florence, I believe. I hope. anyway, back in Elk City, Magruder heard of this new El Dorado, and he knew that the miners would need supplies. So he gathered his mules and some other men to help him, and they made preparations to depart on August 22nd, 1863. But before he could leave, he got some good news.
Magruder was handed a letter indicating that the people of the Nez Perce County had nominated him in the coming election for representative of the brand spanking new Idaho Territory. Magruder felt honored by this nomination, which, if he were to win, meant a trip to Washington, D.C. Magruder sent a reply accepting the nomination.
So traveling with Magruder was his chief packer, a man named Charles Allen, and another guy named L.O. Holt, and then an unnamed pack crew to help with the mules. Now, Mark, I can't imagine what was passing through Magruder's mind as he passed from the mining camp out to the wilderness. This trip was going to make him a small fortune, and he was now looking forward to this election. After years of misfortune, he was finally going to be able to properly provide for his family.
The pack train arrived in Bannock to find it almost a ghost town. Another gold find at Alder Gulch sent miners packing to the newly established Virginia City.
Do you know the whole thing about the name of Virginia City, about how that was controversial?
No. Well, there's Virginia City, Nevada.
Yeah.
Right.
So Virginia City, Montana was originally named Varina City.
Huh.
Verena was Jefferson Davis's wife.
Oh, shit.
The Southerners tried to name it after her, and then I think as a compromise, they changed it to Virginia.
Okay. All right. Which is funny how back east, it's this conflagration between the two opposing sides, but out west, there are like little glimpses of the conflict here and there, but yet mining wins out. Profit, right?
Yep.
Is that how we... You know?
Yeah, definitely.
They almost came to some shootouts at certain times in the Idaho City area, but
yeah,
for the most part, yeah.
We talked about that on, the Confederate Invasion of Boise episode. One of my favorites.
Yeah. That's a good one. And how they'd find out about what happened in battles, like when they're all out in the Placerville Square.
Yeah.
You know?
Weeks after they happened. Yeah.
They're like, oh, man, Fredericksburg went to the, the Confederates, right? Yeah. So anyway. Varina. But Magruder sent the train on to Virginia City while he gathered more knowledge of the area in Bannock. It was probably during this time that he met some fellas named Billy Page, David Howard, and James Romaine.
Which was probably not their real names, but talk about that a little more later on.
Do you think he got it from romaine lettuce?
I hope so.
It is a crispy leaf.
I would name my kid after an onion myself, but...
Walla Walla Sweet?
Ooh, yes.
That's the only onion other than white and yellow.
Right?
And red that I know.
Green.
Yeah, there are green.
Scallops? Or scallions? What are they
scallions,
called?
Scallions, yeah. They're scallions, but that just looks like a little onion to me.
Yeah.
I digress.
Please do.
And so these three men rode with Magruder to Virginia City, where he set up shop.
It took only a little over a week to sell out his goods, and Magruder, Charles Allen, and L.O. Holt returned to Bannock. Holt stayed in Bannock, where he had a business. Magruder ran into a fellow named Bill Phillips, who he had known back in California. Phillips was getting ready to go back west, probably back to Idaho territory, so he joined Magruder and Charles Allen. So he joined Magruder and Charles Allen. Also joining them were two brothers from Missouri, first names unknown, but their last names was Chalmers. So finally, the three men, Page, Renton, and Romaine, who Magruder met in Bannock, asked to go along, and another man named Christopher, I'm going to say as Lower, joined them. Lower or Lower, yeah. L-O-W-E-R.
Good thing it wasn't Matt.
Yes, good thing.
Sorry, cut that out.
No.
So that brings the party up to 9 men, 40 pack animals, and 6 horses. What happened next comes mostly from Billy Page's testimony. The train found the trail and followed it for several days. They were hauling ass, crossing back into the Idaho side of the Bitterroots. The unladen pack train made good time, and the crew got into a good habit of traveling during the day and setting up camp at night, posting a guard to watch over the animals.
Oh, Mark, before I go on really quick, I forgot to mention, I think I messed it up in the script earlier. The 4 men who were traveling with Magruder from Bannock back toward Elk City or Lewiston. So I'm going to call them, Billy Page, David Howard, James Romaine, and Christopher Lower earlier. David Howard, though, I think that name is interchangeable with Renton because these names, they all had 3 different names or 3 or 4 different names because we don't know who these men actually were, what their real names were. They give several different names to the authorities. So if you get confused, David Howard, we're going to refer to him as Renton from now on. Make sense?
Yeah.
Clear as mud?
Clear as mud.
Okay. So on the 7th day, the pack train stopped at camp for the night. Just before they set up camp, Page claims that Lower, Renton, and Romaine took Page aside and told him that they were determined to steal Magruder's, quote, treasure, or the gold dust he earned from selling his goods at Virginia City. Page claimed on the stand that this was the first he had heard of the conspiracy to kill Magruder and steal his money. When Page later did see the purses, he estimated the haul to be around $12,000 in gold dust.
Page claimed he was ordered to sleep next to Phillips. Renton told him to disregard any noise he might hear, but if Phillips was to wake up, Page was to shoot him in the head. Page tried to argue, claiming he wasn't a good shot. I mean, they were sleeping right next to each other, so it was point-blank range. But Romaine then told him to shoot him in the guts instead. Page answered with a simple yes.
Lower, Renton, and Romaine told Page not to worry and that they would handle the dirty work. The plan was called off on the first night because the guard shifts didn't work in the murderer's favor. The following night, though, October 11th, everything worked out just fine. Lower and Magruder were the first to take the watch, and the rest of the men would be asleep so the conspirators could carry out their dastardly deed.
The spot chosen for the camp also worked in their favor. It was off the main trail in case any late-night travelers were passing by. A pasture uphill about half a mile from the camp allowed the animals to graze. Page said that as he settled into his sleeping spot, he saw Magruder and Lower head up the hill to check on the stock. Lauer held an axe in his hand, purportedly to cut some timber to make a fence to keep the animals from roaming. Page watched as the two men climbed the hill, stopping twice to look back at the camp.
So that detail about them looking back, from some of the accounts I read, that Magruder was actually pretty, pretty paranoid about these men, and that he was probably stopping to make sure that Romaine wasn't getting behind him. So he knew something was coming.
Wow. He didn't have a gun, though.
He had several guns.
Oh. Hmm.
And we'll talk about one later. So Page, he was laying next to Phillips as instructed. Charles Allen was in a small tent he usually shared with Magruder. The Chalmer brothers were laying on a blanket near the fire. Page said that around midnight, he saw two men approaching the camp. Recognizing Lauer and Renton in the light from the fire, he knew they were coming to finish the night of terror, which Lauer started up the hill. By waiting until Magruder's back was turned and burying the head of the axe into the poor packer's head.
Ouch. Lauer and Renton were joined by Romaine, who weren't wearing boots, hats, or jackets to keep quiet. Two of the men were holding axes. Page said they approached the Chalmers brothers, and blows of the axes could be heard following it by soft moaning. Page sat up and saw Renton retrieve a shotgun from underneath a blanket and go to Charles Allen's tent. At the same time, Romaine carried his axe to where Page and Phillips were. Romaine told Page to lay still twice, and then, on some unknown signal, Renton's shotgun discharged into the tent while Romaine swung his axe into Phillips' sleeping head. Oh, man.
After the first blow, Phillips rose up and screamed, "Murder!" before receiving more blows from Romaine. Page said that as he was hitting Phillips with the axe, he called his victim a son of a bitch and told him he should never have come along. And he actually added another detail about another man he wanted to come along that he wanted to kill. So I think that kind of shows that Romaine maybe felt bad about killing Phillips, but he wished he was a different person that he did want to kill. So,
jeez,
that's weird. Anyway, after the killing was done, Romaine looked at Page and told him not to be frightened as the dirty work was done.
Renton, proud of his work apparently, showed the rest of the gang how he had blown off the back of Allen's head with the shotgun. After the dust settled, Page was ordered to help clean up the crime scene. Then, as the killers complained about having wet socks from walking around without boots during the murders, they told Page to go up and check on the animals. Page said that as he walked up the hill, he could see a fire burning to the right of the trail. He found out when he returned to camp that Lauer had set that fire over the spot where he had killed Magruder to cover up the blood.
I like that little detail that they were complaining that their socks were wet.
I know. But just... with what, though?
What?
Oh, probably midnight dew.
But... yeah, exactly.
Yuck.
But they had just killed five men and they were complaining about having wet socks.
Yeah, and these weren't men who had done anything horrible to him.
Yeah, they were...
he just was like, hey, look, I blew this guy's head off with a shotgun.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. So also while Page was up that hill, the rest of the men were busy searching for the gold dust, which had caused them to murder these five people. Now, we talked about those, the arpejos on the mule trains, Mark.
Yeah.
The packs. A lot of times what the packers would do back in this day is they would take their gold and they would put it in the bottom of these packs and then put their supplies and stuff over them, because the thought was is that during a robbery, the robbers would have to unpack the arpejos, which would cost a lot of time and energy to get to the loot, right? Obviously, if you kill the packer and the pack crew, you don't have to worry about that. You have all the time you want, sure, right? So yeah. I imagine that's where Magruder kept his gold dust, is in one of those arpejos, or I don't know if I'm saying that word right. So when Page came back down the hill, they told Page that they hadn't found as much gold as they had expected. Perhaps Page was actually sent away from the camp so that the other men could keep the exact total a secret from him. The bodies were the next task to take care of. Allen and Phillips were rolled up in the tent, while the Chalmers brothers were tied to large sticks. Renton and Lauer went up the hill to retrieve Magruder's body. Then all five men were thrown over a steep hillside into the chasm below.
Damn.
See ya.
Yeah. With the bodies taken care of, everything not needed by the robbers was burned, with the exception of the metal items which Page hid underneath a log. The following spring, when Page led officials to the site, it was this bundle that confirmed Page's story was at least somewhat true. Among these items were several guns, one of which belonged to Hill Beachy, who had given it to Magruder before he left for Bannock.
So like I said, he did have... There was four or five guns that they had in the camp, including that shotgun, so...
But that was pretty ballsy of Page, man.
Yeah.
He would have got seen doing that, he would have been boom.
Right.
I would imagine. Or chop.
The book, The Magruder Murders by Julia Conway Wells, she makes the point that Page could have stopped this at any time by just firing his gun off while Lauer and Magruder were headed up the hill, or, you know, doing something like that to signal. But because there's a lot of debate about whether Page was involved more than he says he was, because he says basically they approached him and then he kind of felt threatened to partake in the robbery and the murders.
It's kind of weird. Like, why approach him and have one more person that could get you in trouble? If you're going to kill five men, why not a sixth?
Yeah. And she makes that point too, is they probably regretted not killing him too.
Oh, I would imagine.
So, Mark, that's a good place to stop and talk about Beachy's dream, which is a key element to the story that has long been that Beachy had a dream where he watched Magruder get killed by robbers in the wilderness. And so that's why he gave Magruder that gun for protection. Now, the problem with this element of the story is that Beachy had never said anything about the dream in the courtroom or in later interviews about the event. Julia Conway Welch, in her book, The Magruder Murders, came to the conclusion that Beachy probably just had good intuition, and that because of other robberies and murders, it was a good probability that Magruder could be robbed on the trail. Somehow, in the retellings, this turned into Beachy having a psychic dream about the event.
Seems probable.
Sure.
You know.
And this area of the country really was very dangerous. We talked about Florence, where one of the merchants stacked up flour by his door and slept behind the sacks of flour because men would just come into town and start shooting into the buildings. So he wanted that protection. Or, we could go on and on about how crazy dangerous this place was. Shootouts, you know.
No law, lots of gold. Very little law, I would say. Mm-hmm. Vigilante justice, lots of booze.
Yep. Women.
Women. People from opposite sides in a huge conflict back east. Sounds safe to me.
During this time, though, like you had, they refer to as not highwaymen, what they call them? Roadmen, road agents, right?
Road agents,
and
yeah.
So they had these places called shebangs where they would basically have like these little hideouts near the trail so they could just go out and do their robberies and then go back to their little hideouts. And yeah.
That's cool. I didn't know they were called shebangs.
So it's an Irish term, basically.
Oh, okay.
For like bars, like hidden little bars.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
After cleaning up the crime scene, the four men went to leave the area, but the animals which they had taken care of for more than a week now started following them. After cleaning up the crime scene, the four men went to leave the area, but the animals which they had been taking care of for more than a week started to follow them. The decision was made to shoot several of the mules so that they wouldn't give away the killers. They then headed into Lewiston, where they checked in at the French Hotel. That was their first mistake. You never want to
go
French, man.
Right.
I'll tell you what, you know.
Screw you over.
I don't. Another folklorish part of this story is that Beachy saw them there and that he knew they had done something with Magruder, despite him not knowing that they had traveled with Magruder from Bannock.
So they came up with a plan, and that was to take the stage from Lewiston to Walla Walla, and then on to Portland, and then down to California. We'll talk about how they did that in a second. The problem with that was that the stage station in Lewiston was in the Luna House Hotel, which was owned by Mr. Hill Beachy. And he apparently observed the men when they entered the establishment to buy their stage tickets. Some accounts say that they had their faces covered up, and that made them look suspicious, of course. Now, Beachy was afraid that they were going to rob the stage. But when Magruder's return became overdue, Beachy thought back to the four masked men, and he started to investigate.
Some versions of this story have Beachy as a Dick Tracy-style detective, with him dressing up as a woman at one point while tracking them. No, that was just how Beachy rolled, bro.
That was just what he did on the weekend.
Yeah, it was his time off.
Sure.
But what did happen for sure is he started to track the movements of these men before they left on the stage. He found that they had left some animals at the yard outside of town. When he went to check, he found that one of the horses and a saddle were indeed that of his old friend Lloyd Magruder.
Now, when still no word came from Magruder, he went into full Dog the Bounty Hunter mode.
Dog. Oh, yeah.
A criminal complaint was filed, and Beachy received a requisition or a warrant for the four men. Now, that was signed by acting governor William B. Daniels, who was in charge of the territory while William Wallace was campaigning for delegates for that election that Magruder was supposed to be a part of. So acting governor Daniels wrote letters to the governors of California and British Columbia to turn over the bad guys to Beachy should they be found. And then Beachy, along with a friend named Thomas Farrell, went to Walla Walla on the stage on October 24th, starting the first manhunt originating in Idaho history.
1862.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. The bad guys made it to Portland with a 6-day head start. They probably felt like they were going to get away with the crime, you know. But they chose to wait for the steamship from Portland to San Francisco, which gave Beachy time to catch up. They did board the Sierra Nevada, the same ship that your protagonist in Brave as a Lion,
yeah,
Jeff Stanford, took.
Jeff Stanford rode that ship from British Columbia to California.
Oh, boy. That's a long one, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
But Beachy was right behind them, and as the ship departed, Beachy was meeting with officials to delay the departure of the steamer. This attempt having failed, Beachy and Farrell made the hard ride over the Siskiyou Mountains of southern Oregon.
They made it to Eureka, California, which, you know, we talked about, that's where Hill Beachy did his business back in California, back in his day.
Sure.
So he knew that place well, and he knew he could send a telegraph from there. He did that, and he sent that message to the authorities in San Francisco to be on the lookout for the four dudes that they were looking for. By the time Beachy and Farrell arrived in San Francisco, police had tracked the men to a seedy boarding house and arrested them. The men had deposited a quantity of the gold dust in the San Francisco Mint and were waiting for it to be coined while spending the rest probably on members of the Demi Monde, as Mark likes to say.
The Demi Monde? Yes, mm-hmm. Sir. Page, Renton, Lauer, and Romaine were put in irons and placed back on the steamer for Portland, with Beachy watching over them the whole time. At some point, Sheriff Fisk met Beachy and his prisoners. When he examined the chains, he found that they were being worked at with a file, which was found hidden in Lauer's long hair. Those dainty locks, huh? Mm-hmm. When the group reached Fort Walla Walla, they were provided with a military escort.
I don't think I said, but Sheriff Fisk was the sheriff of Nez Perce County at the time, so Beachy was working quite closely with him, looking for these guys. So when they landed at the dock in Lewiston, a crowd was gathered around, and they were ready to hang the four murderers on the spot. Beachy, it is said, stood with his shotgun at the ready, telling the crowd that the men must face the civil courts, and threatening to shoot anyone who tried to seize his prisoners. Now, this moment would be repeated by Beachy again a few years later down in Silver City, when he was again protecting a man accused of murder, which we're going to talk about in a later episode on the Owyhee War.
I think I know this guy. Which guy?
The guy that killed Moore. Yeah. I can't remember his name.
Oh, I have. He's buried up there now.
Isn't yeah.
Or was. No, that was later in the 1880s than I'm thinking. So, anyway.
Anyway. This is like 1870s because Beachy died like 5 years later.
Okay. Since Lewiston had not gotten around to building a jail, the accused were kept in the Luna House while they awaited their trial. As winter closed off the bitterroots and evidence of the crime, authorities had to figure out how to convict the murderers without the bodies of the men they had killed.
And this is where Billy Page and his testimony came in so importantly.
Really?
So supposedly, it was Beachy who was able to get him to confess. The story goes is that Lauer, Renton, and Romaine were placed in a room and given paper and pencils to write letters home. While they were doing so, Page was led past the room and told that they were writing their confessions.
Oh.
And in the next room Page was led past was empty except for four nooses hanging from the rafters. Now, Beachy made a big show out of telling one of his employees that the room was supposed to be locked, but obviously this would have made a big impression on Page and his commitment to confess the crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Page was probably not, the most hardened criminal. It also, seems like something that they would have on an episode of Law and Order,
right? It's a good idea, though.
Yeah, right.
So Page did, in fact, confess, and his testimony was used to convict the other men of murder. When the trial did start on January 10th, 1854, the defense tried to argue that the court didn't have jurisdiction since the crimes took place in the Washington Territory. But the court was now in Idaho Territory. So the Idaho territory had basically been carved out of the Oregon Territory.
Well, it was Oregon Territory, and then Washington, Idaho was carved out of that. So it was the Washington Territory for a while. And then then Idaho became a territory with Western Montana and Wyoming.
Okay, so it was the Oregon Territory first, then the Washington, and they made it a little smaller, right? Mm-hmm. The Oregon.
Yeah, so Oregon became a state in 1859.
59, right? Okay.
Yeah. And so that left Washington Territory.
Oh, okay. And that included part of Idaho.
And included all of Idaho, and then basically all the way to the Dakotas.
That's one of those things I'll read over and over again, and I always forget.
You got to see the maps of it to really
understand. That, too, at the damn museum downtown Boise.
There's a website, and I need to find it again, but it'll show you the evolution of the counties through each, and it's really cool because it's like a time-lapse thing. I need to find that again.
Yes, sir. This motion, though, was overruled and the trial went on. However, in 1866, Idaho Supreme Court Justice John McBride ruled that since there were no laws in the territory at the time, any crimes committed were not prosecutable. McBride would later go on to regret the ruling because it let some murders and other criminals go free. But based on that ruling, the argument could be made that the trial of Lauer, Renton, and Romaine was illegal.
So this was before the first Idaho Territorial Legislature met. And the first thing that they did when they did meet was adopt English common law for the territory.
Oh, the old common law.
Which our laws are still based on today.
Yeah, yeah.
So if their trial was illegal, then so was the verdict and sentence, which was death by hanging. Page was offered immunity for his testimony, which saved his neck, quite literally.
Yes, sir.
On March 4th, 1864, which was exactly 1 year after Idaho became a territory, the three men climbed the gallows. When they were given their chance to speak, Renton and Romaine tried to put the blame onto Page, accusing him of hatching the plan and carrying out the murders. Romaine also tried claiming that he was an old school chum of Mrs. Beachy, while Renton was reported as crying like a child.
Oh, Renton.
Lauer, however, knew his fate was sealed, and his last words were, "All ready, launch your boat. It's nothing but an old mud scow anyway."
I don't know what that means.
I don't know either.
Not even, like, fucking hang me.
I think so. It's like, let's do it. Let's get it on.
You know, that's the thing. Like, if you really did that and you are a believer in Christianity, like I bet some of these guys were, you would think you'd want to make your peace with God and be like, right, you know what? I did it. I repent. Just so you go, maybe go to heaven.
Just in case.
Yeah, just in case.
Throw an Allah and Buddha while you're at it.
Yeah, that's right. Anybody.
Cover them all.
At 28 minutes past noon, the crank was moved and the three men dropped. Romaine and Lauer died instantly, but the drop was not so kind to Renton, the guy who cried a lot, whose body weight wasn't sufficient to break his neck. He struggled against the rope until strangulation took hold. 30 minutes later, the men were cut down and declared dead.
So kind of an interesting aside about Lauer, which, again, these aren't these guys' real names. We don't know. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about who they were, where they came from. But Lauer, he was the most mysterious. So while the men were waiting to go to their death, like we mentioned, they were housed at the Luna House. A local photographer named Brown wanted to photograph the men, to which they all adamantly refused. After several attempts, though, Lauer assented and was taken to Brown's studio. While the photographer was getting ready, Lauer grabbed his camera and smashed it, claiming claiming he thought it would do him harm. However, he made statements during this time that he was not cool with someone making money from his likeness. And I almost wonder maybe if he was wanted somewhere back east and he knew if his photograph were circulated, then, you know, he could be matched up to other crimes or something. But
we know what I was thinking, not about Lauer, but about Renton, is if the other two heavier guys dropped and had their neck broken and this kid was, you know, choking to death slowly, it's kind of like, can't you just shoot him?
Right.
You know, those two died quick and at least as easily as possible.
Yeah.
Couldn't you just shoot the guy?
I mean,
but then again, I'm like, well, he did, you know, hit a guy in the face with an axe or
right.
blew him apart with a shotgun, I think, right?
Yeah.
Or is that the other two?
I forget. Yeah.
But whatever.
And yeah, I mean, the execution, I mean, by in the death warrant, it will read death by hanging. So if you shoot him, it's kind of a violation of the law, right?
Right.
He could probably be tried for murder at that point.
Yeah, which is crazy, though, because, yeah. you know.
Well, there should be a provision saying if it doesn't work, then yeah. here's your backup method.
But then again, people might have wanted them to suffer. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they definitely did.
So Lauer apparently also promised Beachy the night before the execution that he would offer a full confession on the gallows. But when the time came, he didn't do this. He also told the sheriff to check his pocket for a note with further details after he was hung. The sheriff did find the note, but deemed it as full of obscenities and vulgarities. I like that. Hey, sheriff, fuck you. I was just kidding. But it was not fit to print. So we'll just, you know, guess what was in the letter.
Right.
But a letter printed in the Boise News claimed he knew Renton and Romaine from Marysville, which also means they might have known Magruder there as well. The letter claimed they were from New York, but other speculations say that Renton may have been involved in a bank robbery in St. Louis, Missouri.
And if Renton and Romaine did know Magruder in Marysville, that might explain why Magruder was so willing to take them along on the trip, right?
Oh, yeah, okay. So. But he was still a little nervous.
Well, I think you should have listened to him.
But you think Magruder, if he was kind of nervous or paranoid in the first place, it's like, shouldn't he have kept these men in his sight?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Who knows? Yeah. I probably wouldn't either.
But. Well, there's only two men that know exactly how that happened. And one of them was killed with an axe and the other one was hung. So, and he wasn't talking.
No. Dang. He had a splitting headache, I think.
Yeah, exactly who these men were is all speculation, especially at this point. The men, after they were hung, they were all cut down and thrown into a hole, but might not have remained there long. I've read that they were exhumed by a local doctor who put them on display, which was, you know, a thing that happened quite often.
On the internet and see some messed up photos if you want.
But my question is, why weren't they photographed at that point?
Oh, shoot.
You know?
Yeah.
So, because, you know, there's all sorts of, like you said, there's photos of men hanging or the outlaws that died in shootouts with their guns, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
The holes marked in the photo to show you.
Yeah. Also, one of the men's heads may have been cut off and used for occult purposes until it became too putrid and then it was thrown into the river. So that's something that might have happened. And then, Mark, I remember, because I covered this story back on Cascadia, my first podcast, and I remember reading at that time that the final resting place of the men's bodies is actually under the parking lot at the grocery outlet in Lewiston.
Oh, really?
So.
I have never seen those guys trying to pick ripe fruit before. You know, like just...
What?
I'm just imagining like these hang guys like trying to pick out a nice... pineapple.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or the color of the bananas.
I was wondering if like it's haunted, you know.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That'd be kind of fun. When the snow melted, Billy Page led Sheriff Fisk, Hill Beachy, and the others to the campground where the murders occurred. Many of the details of his confession were confirmed there. The bodies, however, were predated and scattered by animals. Some pieces of bone and skull were recovered, along with the personal effects of those murdered.
I think the State Museum actually has Magruder's gold scale in their collection, so we need to go check that out.
But is it on display? Because that place has so much stuff, or at least the historical society, and it's just like all kept in some weird warehouse, like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, we do have friends there, so.
Yeah, but they have people who aren't our friends that are like way, way up higher.
Oh, dang it.
It's a cabal, man. It's Opus Dei, man.
Well, all we have to do is get a copy of the key.
But we should go see that. Yeah, So Magruder's gold dust, or what was left of it, was recovered and returned to his wife and kids, widowed and orphaned by frontier violence. And that's the story.
So I wonder, Mark, I want to wrap this up by talking about one of the crazier kind of Western stories from this that's connected to this. And that's the story of Henry Plummer. Are you familiar with old Sheriff Plummer?
Yeah, but through reading of other vigilante activity and lawlessness in primarily like the Boise Basin. Mm-hmm. I think it was tied to like the Ferd Patterson Pinkham. Or maybe it was just in the same book.
Yeah, it's all tied together in different ways. And that's something that we need to explore later on in different episodes. And I think Henry Plummer will get his own episode, even though where most of his story takes place and where he died is in Western Montana now. At this time, we're talking about, it was Idaho. It was Idaho Territory. So we can cover it, right?
Right.
So
sure. And we're gonna eventually branch out to Pacific Northwest and Western kind of tales, because, you know, we want to tie it back to Idaho as much as possible, but there's a lot to explore.
Good point. So really quickly, Henry Plummer, he was from New Hampshire or somewhere up in
Updike too. Area. He was a New Englander.
So there's connections too that we'll talk about.
Oh, okay.
So Henry Plummer came out west, went to California and then to Nevada, traced the whole gold rush route like the rest of them did, right? Ended up in Lewiston and then in Florence. He spent time in Florence for a while. A lot of the robberies and like I talked about, the shebangs and the road agents, a lot of those events and those people were tied in with Henry Plummer. Henry Plummer got himself elected as sheriff in Bannock, Montana, or, you know, Idaho Territory at the time. And so he was a sheriff, but he was also running this criminal organization. So the vigilantes formed, took him and a lot of his associates out and hung Henry Plummer on the very gallows that he had constructed himself.
Oh, geez.
Now, after that, his supporters, his people, came to the Boise area, and they got David Updike elected as sheriff. So there's that connection there that I've been trying to flesh out more. I have some ideas on where we can look at that, but we need to do that.
And then old Dave met his comeuppance up on Sarah Creek Ranch out above the middle fork of the Boise River.
Yeah.
Out in that direction. Well,
northwest of Mount Home.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, cool.
But yeah, vigilantes, I mean, we'll discuss more vigilantes in the future. I wanted to mention the Lewiston vigilantes, though, because that's, you know, the area we're talking about. Now, there was a robbery murder that had happened. The perpetrators were arrested, and they were put in a building that they were using as a jail at the time. And it was like this unfinished building that they were working on. And so the men, one of them was connected with a social person in Lewiston at the time. So they had a lawyer that was hired for them. This lawyer was a guy named George Ansley. Have you heard that name?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
He was a politician.
From Boise, right?
Or he came down to Boise later on.
I think he's like buried in Boise, isn't he?
He is. I believe so, yeah. But didn't he have a blacksmith shop
on Main? Yeah, he was something. He's one of the earlier names you associate with Boise City and its development.
So anyway, he was the attorney that was hired to represent these guys, these road agents. So he went to this jail where they were being held, and the jailer said, well, you can't talk to him right now. Come back in the morning. Okay. Uh-oh. So he's like, okay. That night there was reports of shooting and some, you know, noises like that going on. So a lot of the townspeople assumed that someone was trying to break them out of that jail. But anyway, George Ansley goes that next morning to go see the clients, and the jailer says, okay, yeah, they're in here. Come on in.
Uh-oh.
He walks in and they're all hanging from the rafters.
Oh,
the Lewiston vigilantes got them.
Wow.
And I love these Idaho vigilante stories. Like, I can't get enough of it.
Oh, yeah. I like the Boise vigilantes, right? Mm-hmm. Tied to James Reynolds, starter of the Statesman.
Yep.
Right. And there's some pretty solid proof, I would say, isn't there?
I don't know if there's any proof, but there's a lot of speculation, at least.
A lot of hearsay, nothing that would stand up in court these days.
Right. So I'm going to close this out, Mark, by mentioning the Magruder Corridor, which is that portion of the South Nez Perce Trail. That's what it's referred to as now. So it's named after Magruder. Definitely, it's interesting that he's the only one that gets really the focus when there's other victims involved. I mean, we don't know as much about like the Chalmers brothers or Bill Phillips or even Charles Allen. So obviously the focus is on Magruder. And I kind of hate that when I have these stories where you don't have a lot of details about some of the other people.
Right.
Even though they're equally victims.
You take like 2 weeks to look into one minute little detail and waste all this time not looking into other bits of the story.
Exactly. So one of these days we'll have to go up there, and I think the campground is marked out so you can go to see where the murders actually happened. So,
oh, we're going to have to go out there.
Check it out.
Perhaps this summer, Jeff.
Yes.
We'll take our little device and talk from there.
Oh, yeah. That'd be a great, great trip. Anyway, with that, I think, what are we talking about next week, Mark? Speaking of hate.
We are talking about, we're going to focus on Bill Wasmuth, the Wasmuth Center down in Great People. Great work down there at the Anne Frank Memorial Wasmuth Center. But we're going to talk about Bill Wasmuth, who was Father Bill Wasmuth up in Coeur d'Alene, and the Kootenai County Task Force on Human Relations.
Okay, that's a mouthful.
And their fight to take down the Aryan Nations and all the white supremacist haters that came up there from all over the United States. And so we're going to focus on the group that beat them, and they're North Idahoans, Washingtonians, Oregonians, and Idahoans from everywhere. And it was sort of like, Idaho's gotten focused on for, being this bastion for white supremacy and hate. But I don't know why, but you don't hear the narrative as much about, you also had a bunch of people from that area that came out and fought these guys for what was right and that they didn't represent their town. So we're going to take a look at both angles, and we're going to try to present a nuanced story here.
I'm looking forward to that, because I'm probably going to learn a lot that I don't know.
That goes without saying, Jeff.
All right.
Just kidding. I learned a lot this episode, my friend.
Excellent. All right. With that, we'll sign off, and we'll see you next week.
Sayonara.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.
When presidents were men.
That's right. Just kidding. They've always been men.
That's true.
Even the ones that were not.
Some less manly, so than others, manly. And we're going to cut all that out.
Yeah. Anyway.
The Know-Nothings were the anti-immigration,
Trumpers.
they were the MAGAs of the 1850s.
You just say Trumpers, Jeff.
And then you had a guy named David Broderick? Shit.
David Shit Broderick.
David Shit Broderick. Anyway, one of the residents that decided to try his try his, what the hell did I write? Okay. They recycled names pretty widely back
then. Just like Cow Creek.
Yeah. At Elk City, which we'll talk about.
Or Donkey Fucker. Maybe take that out. Yeah. Sorry.
Third paragraph down. Page 6.
Yeah, I thought I had already done that.
Nope. Did you? Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Fuck me.
No thanks.
We'll talk about it. The men had deposited a quantity of the gold dust in the San Francisco MILF.
In the San Francisco MILF.
I'm sure they were making deposits in MILFs.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, when you get a chance to get head.
Take that. I think we need to head out.